Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
I am Lindley Wolf, a maternal fetal medicine specialist and the co-project leader of the TIPQC Cardiac Conditions in Obstetric Care. Today's discussion will be on building a multidisciplinary care team and the importance of having one in place when providing care to women with cardiac conditions. We are grateful to have with us today Dr. Connie Graves, our other co-leader in the Cardiac Conditions in Obstetric Care bundle. Dr. Graves is nationally recognized for her work in cardiac conditions in pregnancy and postpartum. In addition, Dr. Graves has been with TIPQC since its inception. She has served on the board, has led the projects committee, served as a state project leader and co-leader, and as a mentor to the TIPQC leadership team. She assumed the role of TIPQC maternal medical director on July 1st of 2024. Dr. Graves is also the medical director at Tennessee Maternal Fetal Medicine and the director of perinatal services at St. Thomas Health, the co-director of the Comprehensive Perinatal Cardiac Clinic at St. Thomas Health, a professor at the University of Tennessee, a clinical professor at Vanderbilt, and an adjunct professor at Meharry Medical College. She also serves on many state and national boards and is widely published. We are so delighted and honored to have you with us today, Dr. Graves. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with the first question of what exactly is a cardio-obstetrics program and why is it becoming so essential now?
Well, as you know, one of the reasons that cardiac disease and pregnancy has come to the forefront is that cardiac disease is one of the leading killers of pregnant women in the United States, in particular, not just during pregnancy, but in the postpartum period, where women are often vulnerable and are between care. One of the cardio-obstetrics team is a multidisciplinary team, which should feature the patient in the center. And then it's a conglomeration of other specialists, maternal fetal medicine specialists, cardiologist, anesthesiologist, sometimes geneticist, social workers, nurse navigators, and anyone that is needed to provide specialized care and individualized care for a patient with underlying cardiac disease or for patients who develop heart disease during pregnancy.
So we just talked about the different members of the team, but let's just focus for a second on the specific roles with these members. So we'll start with like cardiology. How do you see the cardiologist playing a role in this multidisciplinary team?
The cardiologist needs to be someone who actually has some experience in what we call a pregnancy heart. Often, one of the things I tell people is not just any cardiologist, is someone who has knowledge and has some training or has worked with pregnant women with heart disease. And one of the reasons it's so important that this occur is because of the fact many cardiologists don't see any pregnant women or very few pregnant women during their fellowship. And pregnant women actually have changes in their physiology that make it such that it's just not the same as you were if you were not pregnant. So the role of the cardiologist is actually to understand the heart, understand the lesion and the disease process, then be able to relate it to pregnancy and inform the team how this lesion may act in pregnancy and what happens in pregnancy that may cause other issues.
Okay, that is great, because basically what I hear you saying is that the cardiologist plays a big role along with the obstetrician in terms of discussing what do we do while she's pregnant, or maybe even before she's pregnant, and then during her pregnancy, and then during her labor, for that's specific to each mom, so that it can be individualized to get the best outcome for her.
That is correct. The one thing that I would like to point out, and often in the team, is the cardiologist is not the obstetrician. So what cardiologists should not do, or there should not be an overlap between delivery planning. And so often what happens is that patients get confused, and my cardiologist counterpart will say to me, Ms. Jones came over and asked me if I could, she could deliver, or if she could deliver on this day, or if she could have a C-section, and I referred her back to you. So the OB team should decide on delivery. They decide when the delivery might best balance the maternal and fetal risk after they've spoken with the cardiologist about how that lesion may behave in pregnancy. For example, we know that some lesions like heart failure, some issues like heart failure may get worse during the pregnancy. So it may be that the cardiologist, we all have a powwow and say, this patient is 32 weeks and her heart is not working as well. And we know that pregnancy is a stress test for the heart. And then I, as the maternal fetal medicine specialist, can say to the obstetrician, you know, she's 32 weeks. And if we give her steroids, her baby's going to do quite well in the nursery. And then we can then talk to other team members, such as the neonatologist, who say, hey, yeah, I'm fine with the 32-weeker if you think it's going to benefit the mother. And then we can talk to anesthesia, who should also be on the team, to decide what type of anesthesia would be best, understanding that most of these women can undergo vaginal delivery and do not require operative delivery or cesarean section. It's like running a marathon. And so therefore, when one is in labor, there are a lot of shifts that go on that affect the heart. Cesarean sections are actually much harder on the heart because when we perform a cesarean section, we're more likely to lose blood. We're more likely to have quick changes in how maternal circulation goes. And so those quick changes in that blood loss can actually result in an untoward outcome for the mother. Because we have what we call regional anesthesia, we can use that in most cases to reduce some of those changes. Vaginal delivery is much easier. You're much less likely to lose blood. It is much better for the baby. And so we can have a vaginal delivery. We know that it improves outcomes for both mother, and we know that it improves outcomes for baby as well. And so anesthesia is really important in talking to the patient about what we call regional anesthesia. That's like an epidural, because then the epidural can help us balance out many of the things that may occur. And so it's quite important that anesthesia be on the team and that all team members understand the plan of care, including delivery. As I always point out, you don't need the anesthesia saying, well, you need a C-section, but the rest of the parts of the team are like, well, you know, the data says she needs a vaginal delivery. And our delivery should be based on data and not based on what we think is the best process. And we know from data that vaginal delivery is the safest.
I happened to think of that question just on the moment, but this totally ties back for anybody that's out there that may be a part of our cardiac project, why one of our endpoints is actually looking at cesarean delivery. Because when we're planning ahead and we're preparing for, like, in multidisciplinary committees like this, we are able to do exactly what you just said. Get the what is we know to be safest in the vaginal delivery. But okay, let's shift a little bit to some, we hit the big physicians, the obstetricians and maternal fetal medicine, cardiology, anesthesia. But let's go to the very important but non-physician team members, like our social worker, our nursing staff, and our pharmacists. Like, I was trying to remember in your diagram earlier, like, to include everybody in that, but they play such an important role. And how do we get them onto our team? Who are they and how do we get them on our team?
Boy, that is a great question. So I want to point out to our listeners too that your cardiologist may need other specialized cardiologists who help with certain types of, like if your heart beats too fast or too slow, or if you have heart failure, as we talked about, or if you have other issues that you were born with, you may need specialized heart care. And then in addition to that, you need those people that you just talked about, your pharmacist, who often I know that I've had this issue where I've sent a prescription in and the pharmacist is questioning whether or not that's safe in pregnancy. So it's really important to have them on your team so that we're all speaking from the same page. Also, your pharmacist is really helpful in providing you with alternatives when a medication is unsafe. One of the things that I really like to do is, as we have an OB pharmacist, is sometimes just call them up and ask questions. And then invite them to, if you have team meetings, because now it's really easy to do because everything is virtual. When we have team meetings, we can actually ask the pharmacist to attend. And if they can attend these team meetings, it can actually be quite beneficial for everyone that's involved. Geneticists are really important. We know that 15% of patients with heart failure actually carry a genetic lesion. So getting them to further counsel the patient, not just the patient, but her family and her offspring, on what their a clinical course may look like is important. One of the most important team members, of course, we talked about was nursing. Nursing is going to provide that bedside support when the patient comes in for labor and delivery, or support when the patient comes into triage just with concerns. Often patients are anxious, and I always tell my patients I would err on the side of coming in versus staying at home and worrying about it. So those are very important members of the team. And then last but not least, your care coordinators and your social workers. It is quite difficult to navigate pregnancy even when it's normal. But now when you're asking a patient to come in, take medications, see the cardiologist, see the maternal fetal medicine specialist, sometimes they already have an obstetrician, they need to have a scheduled appointment with the anesthesiologist, it can be overwhelming. And navigating our healthcare system is hard, even when you know the healthcare system inside out. So consider people who don't know the healthcare system. And so that's one of the big things, is having those navigators and care coordinators to help your patient get the imaging that she may need. She went there and they told her, for example, I've had this happen. I've sent patients for a cardiac MRI and someone counseled her that could be unsafe in pregnancy, when we know that's not true. So having her, that navigator to be able to fall back on, is important. And then last but not least, your social worker, because we know that many of our patients need things like transportation. You know, we tell people to eat healthy, but healthy food is expensive. And even if they are trying to purchase the food, often they have a limited understanding of how to prepare foods. So all of those people are really important in getting the team to come together and then closing those gaps so that the patient has less fragmentation of her care.
I did want to just another little plug for how care plans and preparation can really make a difference. I love, well, obviously other states are working on this same kind of results as, or the same kind of project as well. And so Georgia has been working on it, and they had a lovely, I don't know, brochure. I don't know exactly what to call it, but it lists the maternal heart lesion, like a hole in the heart, which is known as a VSD. And then not only does it talk about what to do in the pregnancy, it says what the nurses should do in terms of, you know, watching their fluids, not letting them get overloaded or run. And I thought that is just, when you have each individual person and you make these unique plans, it's so helpful for the nurses to make them more comfortable in taking care of these people. So let's circle back to the actual program. So it's a big, big endeavor to try to get a program started. So what do you think? Do you start small or do you launch it? You try to go full into it? How do you start this program? You get your physicians together, then what's your advice?
So as you know, whenever you start a program or anything, you need to get buy-in from the people who you need to find somebody who is equally, at least a couple of common people who are equally excited about, as you are, about building a program and getting it off the ground. I always tell people that I believe that starting small is important. Find what you need to do. And we talk about this in the TIPQC CCOC bundle. Find what your team is already doing well. It could just be, we're going to meet and have a multidisciplinary program for cardiovascular screening. We know we're doing that well. And now we're going to discuss those positive patients, those people who screen positive, and how we met their needs. That's an easy way to get your team started. Or you may have already been doing the postpartum piece, and you have great follow-up for your patients with high blood pressure, you are really interested in metabolic issues, you have great follow-up for your diabetics, that might be a place for you to start. There are many components of cardiac care, and not every program needs every component. You need the components that are best suited to your institution. So, for example, if you never deliver cardiac patients at your institution, you don't need a team for delivery planning, except for the fact you need to figure out when that patient is going to be transferred out of your institution for delivery, where they're going to go, and what's your contact. On the other hand, if you are a level 3 or level 4 center, you need not only need delivery planning, but you need long-term follow-up planning as well. So you just can't say, well, we delivered the patient, we're going to send them back to wherever they came from because now they're all good. So you need to be able to have, how do you close that loop? Yes, we did deliver this patient who has heart disease. She's doing quite well. We know that she has a provider in the community. We would like to hand her back off to that person who knows her and takes the best care of her. So again, I think it's important for us as a team to realize that, number one, we start small. Number two, we find people who, number one, we start small and find people who are really passionate about what we do. And then number three, if you have a couple of people that are passionate, they usually can influence one or two more people to be passionate. And before you know it, you have a team of four or five.
I really love that answer because I think at my institution, we are trying to get a multidisciplinary team started. And one of the first things we have us as obstetricians and maternal fetal medicine, we got our cardiologists on board. And what the cardiologists that we initially brought on are better suited for the postpartum. So our first process is taking care of, like you said, getting all of our hypertensives in. And now that was our first kind of step. And now we're going to start to focus on the pregnant women and getting that and the logistics, which I think is very complex, of where does the clinic go? When does it meet? Those things are very tedious, but they can be worked out over time. So I think that's the hard part. So let's talk about like standardizations and some protocols and the patients that are referred. Do you prioritize who comes in or how do the referrals get to you? And is it just every cardiac patient or what do you suggest that process looks like?
So as a maternal fetal medicine specialist, I'm going to suggest that you, as you develop your expertise, you begin to see every patient with cardiac complaints. And my cardiologist is like, I'm seeing this patient with palpitations. No, it's not really that exciting. Kind of like when we as maternal fetal medicine specialists say, oh, I'm seeing this patient with an abnormal ultrasound for an echogenic focus. Not really that exciting. But you then allow yourself to develop expertise in maybe working up palpitations. Because I point out to people all the time, again, coordinating patient's care. Patient already paid a copay to see you as a specialist. So then you say, oh, you have palpitations. Let me send you to the cardiologist. Then you send them to the cardiologist and she pays for that, the copay for that. Well, guess what? The cardiologist can't tell her any more than you told her because she has no data. So when they come to see you, the first thing I tell people is to get comfortable working up simple lesions like palpitations. Did you check your labs? Is she anemic? What about her thyroid? How long has she had palpitations? Did you get an EKG? What does her echo look like? Does she need to be put on an event monitor? Now that I have all this data, all patients, and I will say that, again, we talk about this a lot in our HOPE registry meetings. Just because your lesion's a low-risk lesion doesn't mean it's a no-risk lesion. What happens when English is not your first language? All of those things can affect outcomes. So it's very important that we treat every lesion or every cardiac issue with a great deal of respect.
This is just so fun and timely because here I am, we're trying to start this program and I feel like we're not even doing a good job, but you've already touched on one thing, getting the postpartum, which I think we're working on. And then you touched on a second one, which is palpitations. Because once we got connected to our cardiologist, we also got a kind of a pathway for if a patient presents with palpitations, this is what to do. So already I'm like feeling like nothing is happening, but really, we're doing things. And that's nice for me to hear that because it reminds me that things don't just happen overnight and that it takes time. So I wanted to also point out to our listeners out there, if you're a patient, just like she said, and you have an issue, ask for a referral. And if you're a general obstetrician or any provider that is seeing pregnant women, don't hesitate to get the referral to MFM. So just that's something that I know most of us as MFMs definitely feel in these current world of medicine, evidence-based care and standardization is very much a thing. So how do we balance for these women like standardized protocols versus individual plans? Or is it more you follow a certain like guide, you know, or steps and then individualize it in each one? Or just talk to me a little bit about that balance.
I think that's a great question. The hallmark of care should be your standardized protocols. You should start there. So if your protocol says that the patient needs telemetry, then every patient should get telemetry. If your protocol says this patient needs these certain labs or this certain imaging, you should do that as well. I think when we talk about individualized care, it gets into those things that often are that make our patients different. My counseling for a patient with a underlying cardiac lesion who runs 2 miles every day and lifts weights is very different than my patient with the same lesion who is unable to perform exercise. They may look the same. It may be the same diagnosis, but it looks or manifests differently in different patients. And it may be because one patient is healthy other than that cardiac issue that she has. And the other patient has other underlying chronic medical problems, which also need to be managed. Or it could be that, you know, my patient has been an athlete all her life and she just, you know, didn't know that she had an issue. Whereas my patient with the other exact same lesion has been kind of overprotected because her family did not want her to exercise. And so therefore has very low exercise tolerance. So you should always start with your standardized protocols. And then you move out to individualization from there based on your patient, based on their resources, based on their desired for outcome for that particular pregnancy.
That's great advice. Thank you so much. And then we've kind of touched a little bit on who to involve, you know, how to start. Do you have any advice for those of us that are starting to do these programs on how to get the healthcare systems, the hospitals that get their buy-in? Or can you give us examples from your clinic of how it is useful to the hospital, to the healthcare system in terms of outcomes or a way that we can sell it to our bigger systems?
Boy, that is a great question. Because I think a lot of times systems see these things as opportunities to put it out there, right? And they're like, Dr. Wolf is building a cardio obstetrics team. We're going to market it tomorrow. You're like, wait. I'm not even ready to do anything. I just wrote cardio obstetrics on a piece of paper. I don't have anything else. So I think you have to balance moving toward programming. Say, okay, if you want me to build a cardio obstetrics program because we're the level 4 regional perinatal center in my area, these are the resources I'm going to need. This is the buy-in I'm going to need. And it's going to take me 3 years to get it to that point. And while we're planning, I'm going to keep you up and I'm going to communicate all these things to you. However, I also am going to need you to support me with resources. I think that what I have found is a lot of hospital systems have trouble in particular with OB. I'm not sure that they really know always what we do. And sometimes it didn't occur to them that we even have patients with heart disease at all until they see the state statistics and the state or the JCO comes in. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, we don't have these things. And I think that's another place where you can really use protocols and standardization to leverage building your program and to influence your system. Hey, I realize that we got 3 JCO violations because we didn't have this protocol in place, this protocol in place, and this protocol in place. These are things that the multidisciplinary team can do if you give us the resources to get that done. Or the state really wants us to have these things in place. This is what it looks like. what I need from you is to leverage senior leadership to make sure that everybody talks to each other, which is another problem sometimes in getting everybody in the room, putting the egos at the door, and allowing everybody to realize that this is a very complex problem that requires.
That's such great advice again.
I always talk about this a lot. How you ask questions and how you present yourself really helps team dynamics. And actually, I learned this from Stacey Davis, who is my cardiology partner. Even though she doesn't really understand why you're doing something and may not immediately agree with it, she says, can you tell me why you guys put the patient on this medication? But number two, what it does also is it then, instead of me then explaining to you our position, how I was questioned, not that I was questioned, but how I was questioned and what that looked like. But if I walked into the unit and said, hey, can you educate me? I'm just looking at this, and would this patient be a candidate for this type of thing? Versus, you know, me kind of coming in that way. It also helps with patient communication, because now if I've conveyed to the patient that somehow one of the team members is not trustworthy or really doesn't know what they're doing, then the patient loses trust in the whole team. She just doesn't lose trust in me. She loses trust in the whole team, because now I've made it seem like that there's somebody on the team that doesn't know what's going on. So it is much better to ask open-ended questions, to come from a point of trying to obtain knowledge versus coming from the point that you have understanding. And at that point, or for that reason, because there's so many barriers in the American medical system to getting care. Transportation in Tennessee is one of our biggest barriers. For pregnant women, we have the opportunity to actually develop programs that do outreach that don't require I drive 2 hours nor the patient drive 2 hours for care. We need to be better about leveraging these types of resources, especially in a state where many of our rural cities are seeing hospitals close. Patients have to drive farther and farther for care. And if we can somehow partner with the people, the providers in their community, to let them know that we're here and we're available, and you know, we will do the best we can to see the patient via telehealth. And then, for example, I've learned some things doing this. I see patients from all over. I learned that, and like LabCorp has a national system. So if I put the labs in LabCorp, it doesn't matter where the patient lives. She can go and get her blood drawn. And that's something I was unaware of until I started doing telemedicine. Well, that's a great opportunity for me to see the patient, have her get her labs drawn, have them come back to me, and then for me to be able to have a follow-up with that patient. So we really need to leverage our resources.
I love telemedicine as well. I think it's great. My big thing is, how do we get everybody across the state, even the providers, the patients, how do we educate them that this is out there and is a possibility, even because people think, oh, I can do that with my mental health, or I can do it with my diabetes, but I cannot do it with something complex like this. And I think that is potentially a fear. How do we educate our providers, our patients on, in general, the importance of this topic and how we can use other alternative methods to, again, better outcomes?
Again, I think we need to think outside the box when it comes to patient education. So many of our patients use social media. That will be seen by the patient and many patients much more often than the flyers and things we sometimes give in the office. Often I think they get the flyer and then the flyer gets misplaced. And so that's one of the ways to get to patients. Another way I think that is really important to allow this to happen is by using our current state networks. Our regional perinatal center, TIPQC, that sponsors this podcast, is a great way. A lot of hospitals have their own system. Vanderbilt has a system. HCA has a system. I think Baptist has a system. There is a system for Ascension. And so why not use the power of having a large system and have it spread out to those smaller rural hospitals by letting them know, hey, you don't have to come in to the big, I call them in Nashville, the big three. You can stay in your community and we can work up what we need to do. And if we have to bring you out, it's not as often, which also reduces transportation. And let's not forget transportation costs and a reliable vehicle.
It's so true. We often, you know, talk about how it's very easy for us to say, come, you know, when patients are being seen twice a week, come twice a week. But if you're not thinking about those barriers, we really aren't helping our patients. But we're getting kind of close to the end. So one final question. What do you wish you had known before you started your program? Like anything?
Oh, yes. How hard it is hard to change mindsets. And so often, people, when you begin to think about collaboration, and so therefore, getting people to work in the team and helping them understand that we're not here to take away your patients. We're not here to take away the things you'd like to do. We're here just to join with you. And that has been, I think, one of the hardest things to get people to understand. I work in a big system, and some of the people come to our delivery hospital and some don't. And I tell the cardiologist, we're not going to keep your patient forever. We're just going to keep them doing labor and delivery because they're going to deliver over here and you don't come here. And we need somebody who comes to the hospital your patient delivers at for safety. And I think changing those types of patterns, letting people understand that we're not in competition, but that the patient should be at the center. And if the patient is at the center, then we all join hands around the patient to make sure that there are just no gaps in the care that that patient receives. So that's probably the biggest, how do we change people's patterns of referral and their thought processes?
That is a great way to end. We talked about gathering the team, starting small, using what we have, thinking outside the box, keeping open communication. It's just been a great day altogether. So I thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate all the work and we look forward to learning together as we continue to care for our moms and babies of Tennessee.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.